Thank you. Thanks, Tim, very much. Happy to be back in Ann Arbor. And it is beautiful outside. I don't know if it's been down in Ann Arbor the way it's been up in Traverse City, but it's been really cold. So I don't blame people for wanting to be outside tonight. So I thought what I would do, I have a little PowerPoint that has some personal stories about what my life has been like since I wrote memoirs and they were published and the public kind of got an insight into my life. But I thought I would just talk a little bit about my career and how I've gotten to the point that I have, because it's sort of not probably what you would think. I'd never set out to write about myself. I actually used to have kind of the uppity attitude that memoirs were fluff, and I was a serious journalist. And so I stand here with my tail between my legs a little bit, having published two memoirs and feeling extremely satisfied over the process of writing those. So I no longer have that attitude, but I thought I would just talk about how I got here. So I am a Spartan. We'll just start with that. When I went to Michigan State, I always thought I was going to be a veterinarian. That was my plan, which was why I went to Michigan State, because of the vet school they had there back in the 80s. I'll date myself. And when I was growing up, my father is a superintendent of schools, and my mother was a teacher. And so I grew up in a house full of books, and I grew up in a house where I was read to, and where you could put chores off if you were reading, and where we were only allowed to watch PBS, Wide World of Sports, Walt Disney, and when the commercials came on, we had to have a book on our lap and we had to read. We were not allowed to watch commercials. My parents thought that was, you know, that was impacting our psyche too much. So I suppose it's no wonder that I turned into be a writer with that kind of upbringing. And yet I loved animals. I was a really outdoorsy girl. And so when I was growing up, I told everybody that I was going to be a veterinarian. And then here would be my father back there going, "She's going to be a writer. She's going to be a writer." And you can imagine how that went over with a 12-year-old, 13, 14-year-old girl. It was very frustrating. So I got into vet school. I went to Michigan State. I took all those really hard biology and chemistry classes and did just fine. And then I had my first actual veterinary science class, and it was dairy herd management. And I showed up at class, and they put us on a shuttle bus, and they bussed us out to an actual dairy farm. Now, I grew up in a ranch house in the suburbs, so I'd never even been to a dairy farm before. And once we got there, we were told to put on rubber gloves because our assignment was that we were going to artificially inseminate a dairy cow, which we did. And as soon as I got back to campus, I went to the administration building and I changed my major to journalism. So my father turned out to be right for a reason that none of us had really anticipated. And so I graduated with a degree in journalism and another degree in agriculture, and I thought that I would write nature, gardening, farm, outdoor, agricultural stories for the Detroit Free Press. That was kind of my dream. Well, when I graduated in 84, not only did they not have a nature reporter, they certainly weren't hiring. It was a extremely bad recession at that time. And I got one job interview from the placement office. It was all the way across country in a little seacoast town of New Hampshire. And the interview was with a newspaper that had been owned by the same family for more than 200 years. It was ununionized. It came out every day. It concentrated on local news. And they hired only reporters fresh out of journalism school because that was all they could pay. I went in for the interview. And, of course, I thought, okay, student loans. I'm halfway across country. I really have to nail this interview. And at the end of it, I was interviewed by the executive editor. He made all the hiring decisions on the editorial side. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, you did pretty well in the interview, and I just want to tell you, we have never had a woman police reporter before. But if you're willing to try it, we're willing to try it." Now, hopefully women would never hear that today. I really don't think women would hear that today. But I didn't even think twice about hearing it in 1984. I took the job, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I worked there for 5 years. I covered everything from sewer cave-ins to murder suicides to mental patients escaping from group homes and killing people to the elected dog catcher killing two show dogs in the middle of a New Hampshire snowstorm. So, I mean, I covered the gamut. It was a great education. In order to keep your job, you had to write 4 stories a day. And then the next day, 4 more, and the next day, 4 more, and the next day, 4 more. So it was terrific training for a writer. And I thought that, I loved that. I loved being in the know. I loved being the person that took the scanner home at night. So in case any crimes were committed, I would hop in my beater car and race out and take pictures and interview people. So today, when people say the media is controlled, it kind of makes me laugh, because if it is controlled, it was controlled by people like me, fresh out of journalism school, that really were just trying to keep our jobs and keep our head above water and didn't even really know what we thought yet. So it was hard to for us to be impacting the, you know, the way that the news was reported, because when I was that age, I didn't even have any political opinions yet. So it kind of makes me smile when I hear that. So after 5 years, I got married, and I moved back to Michigan, and I started freelancing. And then I started having children, and I had become a writer by then, and so I wanted to write about that experience. So I wrote all sorts of these short personal essays on what it felt like to be a new mom, and they were universally rejected. Nobody cared about them. Nobody wanted them. Even the grocery shopper in my town that had coupons in most pages and were just looking for things to fill in around the coupons rejected those. And I was lamenting about it to a friend, and he said, instead of doing that, why don't you write what you watch on TV? Which is strange, strange writing advice. But at that time, I had little tiny children, and so when they were napping, I was watching something called Court TV. Does anybody remember Court TV? It was on all the time, and I was fascinated by it. All it was trials. It was like C-SPAN for the justice system. It was fascinating to me. So I spent a lot of time watching Court TV, and I said to this friend, I said, well, you know, I miss doing that kind of reporting, and there is this one case that I think I could write about, and it was the Robison family that was killed outside of Goodhart in 1968. They were from Lathrop Village outside of Detroit. And so I thought, well, I could write a book about that. I have the journalism chops, I have the interest, and I certainly have the time. But I had no idea how to go about writing a book. And so I went online and I did some Google searches, and I thought, well, there's a great publisher at my alma mater, so I looked them up. Well, all they published at that time was textbooks. So that was kind of out. They were pretty much just into the academic realm. And then I thought, okay, well, maybe I should look at their rival. And I checked out the University of Michigan Press, and they published lots of trade books, and some trade books that I had even read. And so I sent them an email. And I sent a blind email to editor@uofmpress.gov. Hi, this is who I am. This is the story I'm interested in writing. I know there's not a book about it because I read true crime and I would like to write a book about this case. I think there's a market for it. Well, that's not how you go about publishing a book, but I didn't know that. I didn't know enough to know that that wasn't how you do it. So within an hour, I got an email back from a woman named Mary Irwin, who used to be the associate director here in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan Press. And she said, we're interested, send us a proposal. Well, I later found out that her husband was a big true crime fan, and so she kind of had an affinity for that genre of book. Well, I didn't know what a proposal was, and so I thought, well, this woman's been helpful. I'm going to write her back and ask, Dear Mary, what's a proposal? And she wrote back, and I can still kind of almost feel her eyes rolling, and she said, We have a whole section on our website on what a proposal is. Go to our website and read that, and if you're still interested, send us a proposal. So I did that, and it was quite involved. You had to write a sample chapter and a table of contents and a marketing plan and a biography. I mean, they weren't kidding around. You basically had to write the whole book before they ever even published anything. But I thought, again, I'm interested in the story. It's not like I'm doing anything else. And about that time, my parents were headed down south, and they said, we know you're going through some tough times. I was right in the midst of a divorce by then. I think this must have been 2005, 2006. And they said, we're going to take you and all the boys down south. You can forget about your problems, and you know, you can meet us down there and stay in the motorhome, and we'll camp. Like I said, we're an outdoor family. And I said, well, I can't do that. I've got this book proposal I have to write. And my dad said, you know, book proposal, schmuck proposal, come down south with us. So I did, and I knew the Robinson case so well that once I was down there, I borrowed my dad's laptop, and while they were off with their grandkids, I sat there, and I wrote a book proposal from memory on a picnic table in a campground in Georgia, and sent it to the University of Michigan Press, and 2 weeks later, I had my first book contract. No agent, I didn't know anybody, no. Now, I don't know, maybe that still can happen today. This was 10 years ago now. Seems still really fresh, but you know, maybe it can still happen today. I think probably it's more likely to happen with a university press. So I had these visions in my head after that we're going to have this really tight bond of author and editor relationship, and we're going to get together for coffee, and I'm going to drive down to Ann Arbor and spend the weekend at her house, and we're going to meet each other's families. I mean, I had this whole fantasy. I have a great imagination. So I called her up, and I said, I'm so excited. So what do we, you know, I can't tell you. This is really terrific, and what do we do next? And there was this big, long pause on the other end of the phone, and then she said, what do you mean, what do? You go write a book and turn it in by the deadline. So I did that. It sold pretty well. It's called When Evil Came to Good Heart, and that book's now in its 10th printing, which makes me glad that it's still in circulation. And then maybe about 6 months after it had been published, Mary called me on the phone, and she said, hey, Marty, are there any other dead bodies up there in northern Michigan that you might want to write about? Well, the experience of writing that book made me know that this was what I wanted to do. This was for me. This was going to be the rest of my life. And so I had already started looking for another case, and I already knew another kind of an interesting historic story from my area, a nun named Sister Yanina, who had disappeared at the turn of the century. And a lot of really interesting court maneuvers about her. And I was also really intrigued by what it must have been like to be a nun in northern Michigan in 1907. Can you imagine the work? I mean, can you imagine the isolation? I'm not Catholic, but that whole world really intrigued me. And so I suggested that to Mary, and she said, great. And by then, I knew what a proposal was, and I knew how to write one. So I didn't even ask her that. I wrote the proposal, sent it in, and that's how my second book came to be published and was a Michigan Notable book. So I felt like I was off and running. This is the kind of stuff I was going to do. I was starting to build my name as a true crime author. And people were even contacting me with cases and saying, hey, have you considered to write about this? Have you considered to write about that? And usually after an event like this, someone will come up to me and say, have you considered this case? Or my brother's a police officer, he worked on this case. Or I'm an attorney and I worked on this case. Almost always somebody approaches me after a public event because we're interested in these things. We want to know what happens to people. And so that was starting to happen to me. But I was still writing those little personal stories of being a parent. And by now, I was divorced, and so those stories were about being a single parent. And they had kind of taken on, as you can probably imagine, somewhat of a darker and more desperate and frightening tone, but also hopeful in certain ways, too. But I continued to write those. I just didn't send them out anymore because I knew that nobody wanted them. And I thought, well, someday when the boys are grown, they can read them if they want to. Or more likely, maybe someday their wives will read them. But for some reason, I felt the need to continue to write them. Well, about this time, I was approached by some attorneys in Traverse City. Just like I said, I get approached about cases. These attorneys came to me and said, we worked on a case of some notoriety. We think it would make a good book. We've read your other work. And would you sit down with us and meet with us and see if you're interested in this case? Now, normally, I say no to that because after writing these books, I know it takes a year and a half to research them. takes maybe 2 years to write them. And so when I'm that committed to something, the inspiration, like writers of any topic, has to come from in here. You know, it doesn't come from out there. It comes from in here. So I was about to say no to them, but one of the gentlemen was the Grand Traverse County's prosecutor and had been our prosecutor for a dozen years, and I had voted for him. And the other attorney was his son. And I thought, well, if I'm going to write this kind of book, it would be great if I had contacts in the legal field that I could call and ask questions to. So I'll meet with these people, and if nothing else, I will have made a friend that knows a lot more about the law than I do. So we sat down, and he had me hooked in 10 minutes. I mean, he's dead now. His name was Stu Hubbell, but he was a brilliant, brilliant litigator. And I could see that when he walked in the room and he had a walker, and it was his case that he wanted me to write about. He had just retired. His health was going downhill. And later I would know that this case was very dark, very tragic, and very long and involved. But I didn't know that then. And so when I sat down at the table with him, he said, I'd like you to read this. And he passed a manila file folder across the table to me, and it just had two little pages in it, and they were the happy ending of this long, involved, tragic story. So he hooked me right away with this really dramatic ending. He didn't tell me all of the other things and all of the work and all of the labor, but he hooked me, and in 10 minutes I said, yes, I want to write a book about this case. It's fascinating. I'm your writer. That book was Wicked Takes the Witness Stand. It took me 6 years to write that book. Stu Hubbell died before I finished writing it, which is my great regret. His partner, Ray McNeil, retired before I finished writing it. His son is still practicing, and Bruce Donaldson had just died before I started writing it. So a lot of things happened in the process of writing it. It's 425 pages long. It's a story about five men who were innocent, went to prison, or were convicted for a murder that was probably, and I say probably with a capital P, a drug overdose. And so the further and further I got into the story, the more I felt like such an injustice had been committed. And so it went beyond my career. It went beyond what I thought, you know, financially the book would do for me. It was all about telling a story that if I didn't tell it, I didn't feel like anybody would. So once I agreed to write that book, Stu Hubbell got his grandson to come over with his SUV and a hand truck and wheel in 6 4-drawer legal file cabinets into my house because they had promised me they had the case file. You don't even have to go research. We have the case file, which was one of the selling points. I just didn't realize it was going to take up my entire spare room. but the thrilling part, I think, about that book is that it of everything I've ever written, it is the most difficult, the densest, the least happiest, the most complicated, and the only book to ever make the New York Times bestseller list. So, and it was published by University Press. So while I was working on that book, I thought, you know, I really need to think of this as my career. It's not just a hobby anymore. And I need an agent. I need some national exposure and to be published by a big publisher and not to be thought of just as a Michigan writer or a regional writer. And so I started contacting all of these agents, and you know, they didn't know me from anybody, so I wasn't hearing back from any of them. And then one day, while I was sitting there finalizing this, the Wicked Takes the Witness Stand book, I was sitting in the Gaylord Court Clerk's office, and I had my cell phone. And by now, my sons were in late junior high or high school, and so I was spending my whole day an hour and a half away, and they would come home from school, all three of them, alone in the house, and so they had all these chores to do so they didn't get in trouble. So I had my phone there so that they could text me when they're, this chore's done, this chore's done, this chore's done, this chore's done. Well, my phone rang, and I walked out into the hallway to answer it, and this woman on the other end of the line said, you're not a true crime writer, you're a memoirist. And I said, I'm sorry, but I think you have the wrong number. And she said, is this Marty Jo Link, as if I was grounded or in trouble? And I said, yes, it is. And she said, well, you contacted me about being your agent for a true crime book. And she said, I'm not interested in true crime. I don't do very much of that. But She said, you also attached an essay. Did you know that you put an essay in that email? And I said, no. And she said, well, I really liked it. And if you could write a whole book like that essay, if you can write a memoir, I'm your agent. And I said, but I don't write. That's not the kind of writing I do. And she said, well, apparently you do because you sent some to me. So I thought, well, you know, I said, I have to think about it. Because all those writing guides, that's what they tell you to do when you get that big phone call. You're supposed to say, can I sleep on it for, you know, overnight? Maybe some of you, if you're writers, you've heard that. So I said that. Can I sleep on it? She laughed, and she hung up on me. So I thought, I guess that's how you conduct business in New York. And, you know, I didn't like it too much. So I went back to my research, went home that night, had dinner with the kids, and then I went upstairs and I Googled her because she had told me her name and I had written it down, so I remembered her name. And I Googled her, and then a name came up that was her client, and I thought, well, that cannot possibly be right. So I Googled her again. This time, her name is Jane Distel, and I Googled clients of Jane Distel, and the same name came up, and the name was Barack Obama. So the woman who represented our president was calling me and telling me that I was a memoirist. So I thought, well, maybe I at least should think about what she has to say because she's at least not a crackpot. You know, I had no idea. So I called the kids to breakfast that morning and we had a little family meeting and I told them, I said, you know, I may have a chance to write about our lives. What do you think of that and about that? And they said, well, you've been doing that and trying to get us to read all this stuff for 2 years. I said, no, but this time it would be for publication. And my older son at that time was a junior. I think he was a junior in high school. And he had a garage band. And so anything, I mean, this is in hindsight, but I think anything that kept Mom out of our garage, which was actually a Quonset hut, it wasn't even really a garage, anything that kept Mom out of the Quonset hut, Owen was in favor of. And so he said, yeah, Mom, I think you need to throw yourself into it 100%. You really need to go after it. And then Luke, my middle son, was a freshman in high school, and he's the reader. He's the literary guy. And so he said, yeah, Mom, I think you can do this, and great idea. And then my younger one, who is going to pay for my nursing home, I swear, he said, well, just who would want to read about us? And what would they want to read about? I mean, he was very analytical about it, but eventually he gave me his blessing as well. So I called this woman back, and I said, yes, I can write a book like that essay that you read. And she said, okay, then I'm your agent, and let's get busy. And she gave me a list of 10 memoirs to read. She told me that it would be hard for a journalist to use the word I, and she was right. And she said, once you get over that, you're going to be fine. And she helped me put together a proposal. I thought I knew what I was doing in those proposals, but she trained me how to write them even better. And my first memoir was called Bootstrapper. It came out in 2013, and 7 publishers bid on the right to publish it. And some of the work in there were essays that were rejected by shoppers with coupons. So I loved, you know, knowing that it was published by Knopf, which is, you know, pretty highbrow stuff. So Knopf wanted the stuff that the shoppers with the coupons didn't, which still makes me smile. And then after that book was published, it won some awards. The film rights were sold. It definitely expanded my horizons as a writer. And it expanded the places where I could go and meet people and meet readers. And it allowed me to write The Drummond Girls, which is my second memoir about my 7 best friends and I. Now, if I had tried to write The Drummond Girls first, without all of that journalistic training, all that observation skill developing, and without writing Bootstrapper and learning to use the word I know a publisher would never have said yes to a book about a woman in her midlife with her 7 friends and how they go tear it up on an island one weekend a year. I mean, I just don't see that being a saleable book. But because I had a history at that point, and because I was starting to know what I was doing in terms of writing about my own experience, a publisher said yes. So I was able to write about first my own life, and then the story about the Drummond Girls. Now, most people have probably heard about Bootstrapper. If you haven't heard about the Drummond Girls, it is about 8 women, myself included, who met in 1993, and the first weekend of October of every year since, all eight of us have gone to Drummond Island for the weekend. Doesn't matter what else we're doing, doesn't matter what else is going on in our lives, the same women, the same weekend, the same island. It's kind of like the same time next year, only it's platonic and there's eight of us, I suppose. And I don't see that stopping. You know, we've gone since the book came out, and I can't imagine us not going. One thing that has come about because of that book is, you know, you hear all these like reality shows of people get popular and fights ensue, and we are closer than ever. I mean, that book, if anything, brought us closer together than divided us. I got to interview my friends the way a journalist would interview newsmakers, and that was a privilege for me. So that is kind of just how I got to where I am now. For the second part, I want to just show you some personal experiences of what it's like after the memoirs, after you tell all your secrets to strangers and it's put down in stone or paper. So I have a little PowerPoint for that. So the good. This would have been a picture that took place about the time that Bootstrapper happened. This is a Sunday when I actually got us all to church, I think, on time, and we're basically clean, and our clothes are ironed. So that, during that time, was a momentous occasion and worthy of a picture. So the good part is that I got to share that with readers. You know, I got to celebrate our family and celebrate what we survived. Bootstrapper won the Booksellers' Choice Award from the Great Lakes Independent Booksellers Association. My son went with me that's my youngest son, he went with me to Chicago to pick up the award, and people lined up at a table for the book to be signed, and the first person that showed up after I signed the book, they passed it to Will. And, I mean, he was just sitting at the table to come and ask me if he could, we were downtown Chicago and he wanted to go do something. Well, he ended up having to sit there for 45 minutes and sign books. So there's a lot of booksellers out there that have a copy of the memoir with his signature in it. And that's part of the good, too, because it's his story, too. Your Corgi makes the Detroit Free Press. The Free Press came and sent a photographer and a reporter to my house. They wrote a story about our family. And that is Friday, who unfortunately is no longer around. But one of the good things about writing a memoir is you get to have your dog in the feature pages of the Detroit Free Press. New York Times makes you sound like you know what you're doing. Knopf took out this great ad. And, you know, most writers that I talk to in private feel, I don't want to use the word fraud because that's not really accurate. But you might think, okay, I've written 5 books. I should know what I'm doing, right? I'm probably a pretty good writer, and I sit down, and I just crank it out. Well, I know how to write the books that I've written. That's all I know. I'm going to write more books, and I have absolutely no idea how to write them. The only thing that I have is the knowledge that that's normal. I used to panic at that thought, but that's a normal feeling, and now I know that, so it doesn't scare me anymore. Well, when you have something like this in the New York Times, it really makes you look like you know what you're doing, even if you don't. So the bad. Your neighbors come over and they measure your vegetables to see if their vegetables are bigger than your vegetables. Because in Bootstrapper, I wrote about what a great gardener I am and what great gardeners my sons and I are. So after that, this is my neighbor showing off my really small zucchini. That's one of the bads. And also in Bootstrapper, I wrote about a lot of that is how we fed ourselves. You know, we had a really difficult year, so we raised some of our own food. Some of that was chickens. I wrote quite a bit about it. But then when your work gets to New York City, they have a big hissy fit over if you want to use the word hens or chickens, or are chickens roosters too? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that my editor and I went round and round and round and round on, because if you grow up in New York City and you make it to the higher echelons of editorial department at Knopf, basically you've never raised chickens. I can tell you that. So that was a point of editorial contention. And one chapter of Bootstrapper was entered into a national, all they told me was, we're entering your work into a national writing contest. My editor told me that. We think that this first chapter is so good, we're going to enter it into a contest, which it ended up winning first prize, but only then did they tell me that the theme of the essay contest was the best essay about anger and revenge. I thought it was just for good writing, but apparently it was for anger and revenge, so I wasn't expecting that either. And you can never live down a good subtitle. I will forever be called a badass because Bootstrapper's subtitle is From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm. And now whenever I do events, a lot of times they put that word in the big headline. And sometimes, even when I do it in the town where my parents live, they have to see that and know that that's how somewhat of the public sees their daughter. So that's been a little difficult for my parents. And the totally whack. Have you heard your kids use that expression, or have you heard your grandkids use it maybe? Or, well, it means nutty or extreme nuttiness, perhaps. I don't mean diagnosed mental illness. I just mean nuttiness. This gentleman here is a pretty famous musician in his day. Now, I was at a book event, and he showed up with his unpublished novel and gave me a copy and wanted me to read it. And then he showed up at my next event and gave me a series of traveling music on CDs that he thought that I needed, because I think the first place I was in Minneapolis and then Wisconsin. And then for about 8 months, every time I showed up at a writing event, there was a package waiting for me with a copy of his unpublished novel, more of his unpublished writing, and more self-recorded traveling music. So that has been strange, to say the least. Not scary, just weird. People drive by my house. I'm showing you the interior of my house, not the exterior, because who knows, maybe one of you are one of those people that would drive by my house. You never know. People drive by your house. I don't know what it is, if they want to see that what they read in your book is like the real thing. I don't know. This is my kitchen. And even when they email you to say they won't drive by your house, Marty, have now loaned my copy of your book to 4 people and all have asked where you live. No one is coming to knock on your door, I promise. I've had that happen a number of times, plus people have parked at the bottom of our drive. This is a woman who writes a small newspaper column. And when my husband asks if he can help them, they say things like, no, just wanted to see River Ridge, or just looking for the deer and turkeys Anne writes about, etc. But would you give me a general idea of your address? I'm curious. I think I know where it is. And you get asked out on dates. I'm happily married, by the way. Hello, Marty Joe. I read your memoir book, Bootstrapped, today, and I loved every page, every part of it. I couldn't put it down and to this extent wanted to share my thoughts and feelings. Never has a book so resonated with me. The way you described the work, the garden, the wood gathering, the chickens and pigs, the peanut butter jar, and your boys was perfect. I am a 60-year-old young divorced man. Do you want a date? I have 2 boys myself and am from a family of 14 siblings. Email me back, Ray. You are inspiring. Thank you. I actually get a fair number of emails similar to this one. So I think essentially what I've learned is that when you are brave enough to write a memoir, when you are brave enough to tell about your personal failings and your personal victories for publication, and it gets published to a wide audience, people feel like they know you, that they can judge you, and they are not judging your work only. They are judging your life. These are some of, now I have many, 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 many great reviews on Amazon. But these are some of the more colorful, not so great ones. A stupid, stubborn, selfish person, half her problems could have been solved if she had half a brain. The author is immature and uses coarse language. Take the dang food stamps. Anyone knows that Leghorn chickens are not the right breed for northern climates. So I was even getting reviewed on what breed of chickens I was raising. And I had no Christian redemption whatsoever. So So that's what you're in store for if you are writers of memoir. If you are readers of memoir, be kind to the authors and know that that author is a character. You know, she or he might not be like that all the time or anymore. She or he was that person in the time period that the book took place. I still, Bootstrapper, if you have not read it, it is about a year of financial hardship with my boys and me. I was unemployed, and we pretty much raised or killed all of our food that year. I still, to this day, sometimes go to a bookstore to do a book signing. It's been 10 years since the Bootstrapper year, and people bring me canned goods. So I was that person, but I'm not that person anymore. Although that just, I mean, that's thrilling to me that it resonated with people that much, that book resonated with people that much. But for personal writing, that's what you're in for. For the more journalistic writing, you certainly can be reviewed on your ability to interview or to tell an interesting story, but nobody is going to write on Amazon, you know, she never should have been driving that Ford. She should have been driving a Chevy. Or she never should have used a plaid briefcase. She should have had a leather one. But when you write memoir, it's different. It's kind of open season. And if you're interested in writing that, you have to prepare yourself for it. And if you are a reader of that, be kind to the author. So that is kind of a day in the life maybe or a few weeks in the life of a full-time writer. That I don't have any other job. I exclusively write for my living. And if any of you have questions for me about any of my books or about writing or about publishing or your own work or anything that you've struggled with, the publishing industry, how crazy it is, if I can answer them, I will.
I was wondering with the Isidore's Secret book and the complicated Gaylord book, do you do your own research 100% or do you get some help? That looked like a lot of work, digging through files from 1906.
Yes, it was. I do all my own research, and I do know writers who have hired research assistants, and I'm not sure why I haven't done that. It's either because I don't want to pay the money, that's part of it, but I think a bigger part is I don't know what I'm looking for until I find it. And so the research assistant's sensibilities are going to be different from mine. And I'm not, sometimes a detail will pop out at me that maybe wouldn't interest them, and then I can connect it to this and this and this. So at this point, I do all my own research. I do have a couple of retired attorneys who I have read everything to make sure that I'm not making any legal mistakes, that I'm not using the wrong word, because, you know, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not trained as an attorney, and I certainly don't know the law as well as an attorney, although I think I might be able to pass the criminal section of the bar now after writing these books.
Anyone else? Yes.
I'm just wondering, does this thing work? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Did you have the same publisher for Drummond as you did for the first one?
I did not. I had a different publisher for Knopf published Bootstrapper, and the book that they wanted me to write, I was not interested in writing that book, and so and they were not interested in publishing the Drummond Girls. But many other publishers were interested in it, and I ended up going with Hachette.
Okay. Yeah,
Grand Central Publishing is an imprint of Hachette, and they published the Drummond Girls.
Someone else?
So how?
Oh wait, oh, okay. Another question back over here.
The poor characters who spent years in jail, do you have any follow-up on them?
I do. Yeah, I do. Don Hestand and his wife Lisa became pretty good friends of mine. And Don is the one who worked, for those of you, if you have not read Wicked Takes the Witness Stand, it is from Gaylord, and an oil field worker was found in his pickup truck frozen, and five men went to prison for his murder and supposedly planned it together. So it was conspiracy and murder. Don Hiestand's role in that case was to work part-time for 2 weeks at a butcher shop processing deer. That was the extent of his crime. And he got, but he got pulled in. And so he and his wife, Lisa, became pretty good friends of mine. When I went to Gaylord to present the book, I was a little bit nervous, as maybe you can imagine. And it was standing room only at the bookstore, and they had police at the door because the bookstore had gotten some threats. And so, and I knew all this. Well, I called Don before I went in to give that talk, and I said, okay, Don, I'm going to do it now. Give me the rah-rah. And he said, you go get him, girl. You can do it. So we were close like that. And 3 months after the book was published, he died of a massive heart attack, and he wasn't even 60. He had diabetes, and all that time in prison ruined his health. He wasn't able to check his blood, and he had to eat starchy food. And so he had many health problems after he got out of prison. His wife is just now starting to be, you know, better. So that was tragic and difficult. The two brothers are extremely bitter and never really fully regained their life. They're in contact with me somewhat. The one person who I never spoke with, Doug Brinkman, called me after the book was published, and he said, I hear there's a book out about me. And I said, well, it's about you and the other four men. And I said, I can't tell you how hard I looked for you when I was writing it. I wanted to interview you then. And he said, yeah, well, I pretty much disappeared. I've been in Louisiana and, you know, kind of off the grid, he said. And I said, have you read the book? And he said, no, but my girlfriend's read it. And I said, what did she say? And he said, she finished it, and she looked at me, and she said, so you mean to tell me all that stuff that you told me is true? So that's what I know of the men since the book came out.
Thank you. Oh, right here.
Have a comment. Do you have stock in tequila rose? Because since the Drummond Girls, we have it in our refrigerator all the time.
It's good, isn't it? I don't have stock in tequila rose. No, but they do stock it up in the Northwoods now, whereas they didn't stock it before. So,
okay, another question here.
Oh, go. Okay. That's another thing. When you write about your life, you have to be ready for people to ask you personal questions.
Well, this is actually. Okay. I just want to know who bought the film rights for Bootstrapper.
The film rights to Bootstrapper were purchased by an actress. She bought them for 1 year, and then she renewed it. And the actress is Rachel Weetz.
I saw that. I actually read that. I didn't realize when I read that.
Yes, and I think she's fantastic. She's a British actress. And there's kind of a humorous story about how I learned that the rights had been sold because, you know, that's sort of an author dream, really, to have that happen, especially by a quality Academy Award-winning actress, not by just some someone who maybe that you don't enjoy their skill. So I was on my way to we get together, the Drummond Girls and I get together once a month at Linda's house, all just, you know, just to talk. And I was on my way, and I was supposed to bring a dish to pass, and I hadn't made anything. So I was in the grocery store parking lot thinking, okay, now what can I go in there and buy that's going to look like I made it? And my phone rang, and it was Jane, my agent, and she said, do you know who Rachel Weetz is? And I said, isn't she an actress? And she said, she's the actress that wants to play you in the movie. And she said, I think we just sold the film rights or film option. I said, oh, my gosh, that's great. And then she told me a little bit about Rachel, and she was in the Mummy movies. But then she was in a pretty great movie called The Constant Gardener, and that's what she won the award for. And then she said, and she's married to Daniel Craig, which I hadn't known, Daniel Craig 007. So I immediately call my husband, and I tell him the news, and he says, wow, that's really great. I said, and did you know that she is married to Daniel Craig? And there's just this quiet kind of pause on the phone. My husband's very dry. And he said, well, if he works out, he could play me. Just like deadpan, you know. I mean, my husband plays hockey 3 times a week, and he is in good shape, but he's not Daniel Craig. So that was very funny. So it was thrilling to sell it. She did renew it. They did hire a screenwriter to write the screenplay. They apparently didn't want my screenwriting skills. They hired someone to do it. But I haven't heard from them. I think right now they're looking for funding to make the movie. So we'll see. It could come to nothing, you know. But it would be neat.
Oh, wait a second.
Yes.
Hang on just a moment.
My question was because I can't imagine, I know who Rachel is, and she's very British, and I'm just trying to figure out, why does she want to play a woman in the backwoods of Michigan?
Well, I think her, she's quite the feminist, and she has a son. And so her son, I think, is 9. And she and I have emailed a couple of times, and what she mostly talks about in those emails is her relationship with her son. So I think that is what spoke to her from the book.
Yeah.
And that's what she could relate to.
I get that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone else.
Well, thank you very much for coming out on this lovely evening to hear me talk. I really appreciate it.